Yeats in 1913 said that Ireland was like plastic, that it was ready to be moulded.
What you have is 20,000 households who are living in one room.
If Jim Larkin's great achievement was to unite workers in the belief they could actually win better conditions, William Martin Murphy's achievement was to unite employers, Catholic and Protestant, that they could beat the other side.
But soon the strike was seen in terms of a clash between Murphy and Larkin.
Murphy was constantly being lampooned as the viper of Dartry Hall, where he lived, a worker's tyrant.
History was written by men, so an awful lot of women that contributed to Irish society have been written out.
I think it's right that we give fair truck to the William Martin Murphy aspect and on the path it sent us on.
But it was tragic, the way it ends. But Larkin was still loved.
It was a very traumatic experience, but it did give the people of Dublin and Ireland the belief that they could change things.
It's been presented as this great labour dispute and it was a success. It wasn't. It was not a success. These men had nothing. Their families had nothing. Their children had nothing.
It seems to me that you could make a huge parallel between what's happening now in Ireland and what happened in the period before the lockout.
Sometimes I think we look back at the lockout and its legacy and we read history backwards.
There's a real danger of commemoration being a form of nostalgia rather than trying to extract from what happened 100 years ago messages and challenges for today.
Citizens.
Lockout. 1913 to 2013.
By Tuesday evening, August 26th, 1913, on the first day of the tramway strike, the trains are running normally. The tram drivers had walked off just before 10 a.m., but the stoppage was short-lived. William Martin Murphy had put contingency plans in place. The crowds leaving the first day of the Dublin Horse Show head home, many unaware of the morning events. But frustrated crowds in the city begin stoning trams, and that night service is stopped. Police begin protecting the trams. That night, union leader Jim Larkin addresses a crowd of several thousand at Beresford Place. Striking tram drivers are wearing their uniforms and the union red hand badge.
This is not a strike. It is a lockout of men who have been tyrannically treated by a most unscrupulous scoundrel. We are fighting for bread and butter.
The idea that the tram strike crippled the city, or that it was in itself a success, is perhaps one of the myths of the lockout, where the story often gets told to suit the perspective of the teller. In this episode, I'm tracing events from the start of the strike in August through to Christmas 1913, and using, where possible, contemporary eyewitness accounts and newspaper reports to give a sense of what happened. Here's how the Irish Times reported it.
Many of the men on strike were noticeable in the streets during the day. They still wore their uniform, though they are under obligation to return them to the company. They also sported badges depicting a red hand, the symbol of the Irish Transport Workers' Union. An attack was made on one of the tram cars at Arran Quay. The glass panelling of the car was smashed by missiles thrown by a group of toughs on the sidewalk. Two bricks and a bottle were thrown at the car, and they crashed through the windows, some of the passengers having narrow escapes.
The Irish Times, then a newspaper of the Protestant elite, was as much anti-Larkin as Murphy's own newspapers, the Irish Independent. I'm over at Pierce Street Library to find out how the story is reported at the time and just what people are hearing and reading. Librarian Maura Kennedy is helping me look through the microfilm.
Well, the first paper that we have here is the Evening Telegraph. So this is a nationalist paper. And we're looking at Tuesday, the 26th of August. And the headline that strikes us here is Tram Strike Starts. For a time, considerable excitement and confusion prevailed at Nelson's Pillar when drivers and conductors left many of the cars. And then it tells you that seven of the drivers were taken into custody, and it tells you that other drivers were brought along to replace them. And it ends up by saying, the seven tram employees charged with obstruction at the pillar were remanded for a week. And it tells you also that all the trams were back up and running by 1 o'clock.
Arrests become common in the days that follow. There's protests and marches by the strikers. Those continuing to work are labelled scabs and jeered, but life in the wider city continues largely unaffected. Ladies' Day at the Horse Show is a success. Here's the Irish Times report from Thursday.
Olympia, in all its glory, could not excel the spectacle presented yesterday afternoon in the picturesque grounds of the Royal Dublin Society at Ball's Bridge. From every point of view, charming pictures met the eye. Youth and beauty, fashion and elegance. It was par excellence the Ladies' Day. Many of the dresses worn by the fair sex were remarkable, if not daring in their originality, while others were beautiful examples of skill and taste.
Wednesday, Thursday and Friday of that week are tense. There's sporadic violence, clashes at night, more arrests. A heavy police presence is around union headquarters. Some Dublin employers are beginning to follow Murphy's lead and sack union workers. Those replacing strike workers are being attacked. There's another big rally at Beresford Place on Wednesday night. Emotions are high. Larkin calls for retaliation.
If one of our class should fall, then two of the others must fall for that one. We will hold our meetings in the street, and if any one of our men should fall, there must be justice. By the living God, if they want war, they can have it.
On Thursday morning, Larkin is arrested for sedition and libel. He's accused of inciting hatred among certain classes of His Majesty, namely the working classes and the police forces of the Crown. While Larkin and the other leaders are in the Bridewell, word is sent to Belfast for James Connolly to come down and take over.
It is then upon this working class so enslaved, this working class so led and so enriched with moral purposes and high aims, that the employers propose to make general war. Shall we shrink from it, cower before their onset? 1,000 times no.
Connolly addresses the Beresford Place rally that night and writes a call to action for the union paper, The Irish Worker.
Shall we crawl back into our slums, abase our hearts, bow our knees, and crawl once more to lick the hand that would smite us? Shall we, who have been carving out for our children a brighter future, a cleaner city, a freer life, consent to betray them instead into the grasp of the bloodsuckers from whom we have dreamt of escaping? No, no, and yet again no.
Larkin and the others are released on bail, but the authorities ban the union's plan for a big rally on Sunday in O'Connell Street. Larkin burns the proclamation and declares they will march anyway.
We will demonstrate in O'Connell Street. It is our street as well as William Martin Murphy's.
By Saturday morning, August 30th, the Irish Worker comes out with Connolly's words.
Let them declare their lockout. It will only hasten the day when the working class will lock out the capitalist class for good and all. If we're taking the side of the tram men, we are threatened with suffering. Why, we have suffered before. But let them understand well that once they start that ball rolling, no capitalist power on earth can prevent it continuing to roll. That every day will add to the impetus it will give to the working class purpose, to the thousands it will bring to the working class ranks, and every added suffering inflicted upon the workers will be a fresh obstacle in the way of moderation when the day of final settlement arrives. Yes, indeed. If it's going to be a wedding, let it be a wedding. And if it's going to be a wake, let it be a wake. We are ready for either.
By Saturday afternoon, Connolly is arrested. He refuses to recognise the court and is sent to prison. Larkin is in hiding, believed to be staying with Constance and Kazimir Markovic.
This is the Saturday Herald on microfilm from August the 30th. Now, this paper was owned by William Martin Murphy, the same as the Irish Independent and Sunday Independent. And the headline here on the front page is Keeping Larkin on the Run. Messrs. Connolly and Partridge in custody, Larkin and his dupes, a lesson for Larkinism. So you can see it's really quite vigorously taking a stand against Larkin and on the side of the employers.
That Saturday night, rioting breaks out in Ringsend and along the quays. Police clash with strikers who are angry at the arrest of Connolly and the banning of Sunday's rally. One man, James Nolan, is injured by a police baton and dies later.
I saw the police charge the doorway and smash the side lights. They charged round Eden Quay. The majority went on the footpath, charging the people there. The people, for the most part, kept to the quayside. I stood in the shadow of the Corporation Weighhouse and saw poor Nolan trying to get away. I saw a police constable, 224C, Constable Bell, strike him with a baton. I saw him fall to his knees. The constable ran on, and then 149C struck him across the neck.
The account of Stephen Gilligan there, an eyewitness to the attack. The union leaders, wary of the potentially explosive situation, agree to cancel the Sunday rally in O'Connell Street and instead gather in Croydon Park in Fairview. Lockout author Porrick Yates takes up the story.
They marched them all out to Fairview, to Croydon Park, which is a union recreation centre. And they had a big rally there, very peaceful, and they addressed the workers in usual sort of speeches, and they all marched back to the city again, and everyone thought it was over. Unknowns to them, Larkin, being the maverick he was determined to keep his pledge to speak in O'Connell Street.
He was doubtful about the advisability of going on with the meeting, a little bit doubtful, but we all persuaded him he couldn't let his own side down by simply obeying the proclamation.
Helena Maloney there, interviewed for the 50th anniversary of Lockout when she was 80 years old. Maloney is both an actress and a political activist. She's a close friend of Maud Gonne and Constance Markovitch. And it's Maloney and Casimir Markovitch who disguised Jim Larkin that day so he can sneak into the Imperial Hotel and deliver his speech.
So Madame Markovitch invited him up to her house, the Count was there, and he stayed the night. And the next morning, I had my makeup box, of course, in the house. I made him up as an elderly clergyman. You see, we had a frock coat and all that, all that was necessary, and a good, nice grey beard, very discreet, and made up to a man about 70.
The plan is to take Jim Larkin to the Imperial Hotel. It's deliberately chosen. It's William Martin Murphy's property in the middle of O'Connell Street, next door to his other landmark building, Cleary's.
It was unthinkable that Madame Markovitch or I would go with him, because I at that time was very well known to the police, because I'd been arrested a couple of times already. So we called a cab, and a great friend of ours, Miss Nell Gifford, she accompanied him down. Ordinary clothes, because she wasn't. She was quite a dark horse. She went down with him, ostensibly his daughter, a young woman, you know, and they both walked boldly into the hotel and upstairs and into the, I think it was the dining room that overlooked the street.
There's a famous story that he was smuggled into William Martin Murphy's own Imperial Hotel. Apparently when he got up to the room he'd booked, there was a big aspidestra in the window, and he had to lift it down, and then he found the window was nailed shut. So he sort of ran through the hotel to the dining room, which was on the first floor, and he ran out through the dining room, past all the guests, pulling off these false wig and disguise, and he ran to the balcony and started to address the crowd from the balcony.
He stepped out on the balcony and opened his address at once, and with his great volume of voice, you know, to carry half across the city, Jim Larkin's voice.
Men and women of Dublin, I address myself to anyone who is listening. My time is mightily prescribed. I care for no man or men. I have got a divine mission, I believe, to make men and women discontented. I want to make you discontent, to want for better.
The police, who are in rows down below, at once alerted and dashed into the hotel and upstairs, and of course picked him off the balcony very quickly before he had, I should say, a dozen sentences.
Ah, here come the little boys in blue. Have no fear, I'll be back. What can they do, kill me? There are thousands to come after me.
But they dragged me in and loaded them off. So I and Madame Markovitch and the Count Markovitch, we were on a car, a sidecar, at the far side of the street watching with interest to see what happened. So we saw it all. Well, the police then got savage, and they were very angry at being circumvented like that. And they advanced on the crowd, and that right and left. Really a savage, because people were knocked down. Lots of people were knocked down. And they were doing nothing, and only standing there. They weren't even ordered to disperse before the war happened.
But the people he was addressing were day trippers. They were the curious people coming in to see if anything would happen. A lot of them were mass-goers. There was a William O'Donnell, one of the witnesses, a very good witness in the subsequent inquiry, who had actually been doing his books. He was had a men's outfitters in O'Connell Street. He was a partner there. He was doing the books on Sunday morning, which he probably shouldn't have been as a good Catholic. But he came out and he was on his way up to the priest club to join some clerical friends for lunch. So these were the type of people who were in the street. And the next thing, the police panicked and they baton charged the crowd. And anyone in their way was just literally battered into the ground, including Mr. O'Donnell, who ended up in Jervis Street instead of the priest club. But afterwards, it didn't suit the unions to say, well, we weren't actually there. The police were portrayed as the minions of Dublin Castle. The employers could say, well, we weren't responsible, we weren't actually there. So a new history was reinvented very quickly about what had actually happened that day.
A teenage Ernie O'Malley, who later goes on to fight in the War of Independence, was an eyewitness on the day.
Police swept down from many quarters, hemmed in the crowd and used their heavy batons on anybody who came their way. I saw women knocked down and kicked. I scurried up a side street. At the other end, the police struck people as they lay injured on the ground, struck them again and again. I could hear the crunch as the heavy sticks struck unprotected skulls.
By Monday, the horror of what became known as Bloody Sunday is emerging. James Nolan and a second man, John Byrne, both die from injuries incurred in Saturday night's riots. But it's clear that the violence on Saturday night feeds into the police reaction on Sunday.
This is the Evening Telegraph, and the date is Monday, the 1st of September. So that's the day after what became known as Bloody Sunday. And we're getting a number of headlines here. The main headline is Bloodshed Night and Day. And then it goes on, it says, Appalling scenes in city, fierce baton charges, hundreds injured, two men dead, the hospital record, Jervis Street 320, Mercer's 50, Dunn's 65, Mr. Larkin arrested in the Imperial Hotel. So you're getting it all there in a nutshell in the headlines. And then across the page from that, they're showing five different pictures of the events. The first one here is the image that you usually see outside of the Imperial Hotel. You see the police baton charging the crowd. And the next one is taken at Abbey Street. Again, you see people running. You see the tram tracks on the road. You see the police after them. And here you see the empty street, and all you can see are the police on horses going down the empty street.
Bloody Sunday is a turning point. Larkin's perhaps reckless decision to force the situation and the violent reaction of the Dublin Metropolitan Police mobilises support, not just in Ireland, but within the trade union movement in Britain. With Dublin hospitals already stretched, coping with Sunday's injured, an event on Tuesday, September 2nd, highlights the conditions many people are living in. Two tenement houses on Church Street collapse, killing seven people, including three children.
I was standing in the hall door of the house, looking at the children playing in the street. Other women were sitting on the curbstone so as to be in the air. And suddenly, I heard a terrible crashing, shrieking. I ran, not knowing why, but hearing as I did a frightful noise of falling bricks. When I looked back, I saw the two houses had tumbled down. I did not know what I did then, but I remembered rushing. There was a heap of bricks and stuff piled up on the street, where a moment or two before, children were playing and women sitting watching them.
The words there of an eyewitness, Mrs. McGuire, who lived in one of the houses. In the months that follow, there's two public inquiries. The Asquith explores the worker-employer conflict and the lockout, while the other, the Dublin Housing Inquiry, investigates the often appalling conditions in Dublin and proposes solutions, solutions which are largely parked until the 1930s. By Wednesday, the day after the Church Street collapse, the funeral of James Nolan takes place. Thousands of strikers turn out to follow the cortege to Glasnevin. Nolan, it seems, was not involved in the Saturday night riot, but was simply caught up as he came out of a pub. British Labour leader Keir Hardie attends the funeral and addresses strikers later, pledging the support of the British trade union. Arnold Wright describes the scene.
Thousands of strikers in motley mourning and wearing in conspicuous places on their coats the red hand, the badge of the union, marched in the procession. A considerable contingent of tramway men on strike and in uniform in the line of the mourners attracted much attention, as did also many individuals whose bandaged heads and generally battered appearance marked them out as the wounded soldiers of the campaign.
At the same time, William Martin Murphy addresses the Dublin Chamber of Commerce. He's president there, and the Dublin Employers' Federation. They support his actions in the tram strike.
I wish to express my sincere thanks to the meeting for this resolution. I am particularly proud of it, and I'm also proud of my exertions. I have seen for a long time that the head of the labour agitation in Dublin has been aiming for a position that was occupied some time ago in Paris by a man who was called King Pateau, who was able to hold up the whole business of the city by lifting his little finger. That man was driven out of Paris, and the other man will be driven out of Dublin shortly. The question I have fought in connection with the tramway company was not one of wages or the treatment of those employed in the tramway service. The whole issue was the supremacy of Mr. Larkin and whether he was going to rule the trades of Dublin and whether men could be able to carry on their business and in fact be able to call their bodies and souls their own unless they went cap in hand to him. The position was becoming intolerable. It was time to stop this man, and I think I have stopped him. I did not get into the matter in a light-hearted or haphazard way. I had laid out my plans of campaign and prepared for any emergency that might arise. Larkin is now under the protection of the police. His victims, the employers, have been under the protection of the police for some time. But for the past week, Mr. Larkin appeared to have been craving for the police himself and to get inside jail, which would be the safest place for him when his victims are looking for him and find there is no strike pay for them. The fight against Larkin was not, after all, so difficult. It was easier than it appeared. The prospect of a strike and the anticipation of it had much more terror for the employer than the actual strike when it took place. An employer who had never been up against a strike was terrorized at the prospect. When the strike actually took place, the employer had to get his back to the wall and the workman had fired his last cartridge. The employer all the time managed to get his 3 meals a day, but the unfortunate workman and his family had no resources whatever except submission, and that was what occurred in 99 cases out of 100. One of the helps we have had in this strike has been that Mr. Larkin has provided an antidote to the poisonous atmosphere which he himself has created. The antidote is the hundreds of men he has thrown out of employment who can easily be had to take any work and undergo any risks, so sad is their plight.
And over 400 employers, a roll call of Dublin business, agree a mandate stating that they will not employ anyone who continues to be a member of the Irish Transport and General Workers Union and stating that they will instantly dismiss anyone who remains a member of the union.
This is the Irish Independent here again on microfilm. It's Thursday, the 4th of September 1913, and we've got the headline that says Crushing Larkinism. And the subheads are Resolute Stand, Declaration by the Employers, No Transport Workers, Shippers and Carriers Join Movement, and Lord Mayor and a Truce. And the opening paragraph is very strong. It says, Larkinism has been crushed in a determined manner in Dublin. Employers who have no quarrel with legitimate trade unionism declare that they will no longer tolerate the despotism and tyranny of the transport union, which have been paralysing trade and commerce. So this is as a result of the employers' meeting, and they're actually very strong against Larkin.
All workers are asked to sign a document stating that they'll resign their union membership and that in the future they will not join or in any way support that union. The lockout is now complete. Thousands refuse to sign and are sacked. James Connolly, when he's released from prison, writes this piece in the journal Forward.
To the readers of Forward, possibly some sort of apology is due for the non-appearance of my notes for the past few weeks, but I am sure that they quite well understand that I was, so to speak, otherwise engaged. On the day I generally write my little screed, I was engaged on the 31st of August in learning how to walk around in a ring with about 40 other unfortunates kept 6 paces apart. The first question I asked was generally, "Say, what yen for?" Then the rest of the conversation ran thus. "For throwing stones at the police." "Well, I hope you did throw them and hit." "Are you in the Irish Transport and General Workers Union?" "Of course I am." "Good. Well, if they filled all the prisons in Ireland, they can't beat us, my boy. No, thank God, they can't. We'll fight all the better when we get out. I heard of one case where a labourer was asked to sign the agreement for swearing the Irish Transport and General Workers Union. And he told his employer, a small capitalist builder, that he refused to sign. The employer, knowing the man's circumstances, reminded him that he had a wife and six children who would be starving within a week. The reply of this humble labourer rose to the heights of sublimity. "It is true, sir," he said. "They will starve, but I would rather see them go out on in their coffins than I should disgrace them by signing that." And with head erect, he walked out to share hunger and privation with his loved ones. Hunger and privation and honour. Defeat? Bah! How can such a people be defeated?